From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Protests across the country continue after the murder of George Floyd. Now, all four officers involved in his death face charges.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice.
No peace.
A memorial for George Floyd. Reverend Al Sharpton led a moment of silence, 8 minutes, 46 seconds, for the time the officer kept his knee on Floyd's neck.
What happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
And on Monday, President Trump addressed the nation. He said he was prepared to deploy the military to address the violence and unrest.
We are ending the riots and lawlessness that has spread throughout our country. We will end it now.
It's our Week in the News roundtable, and we do have a great panel to break it all down for us today. Kimberly Atkins, senior news correspondent for WBUR, covering national political news from Washington, D.C. Kimberly, welcome.
Hi there, Jane.
Adam Serwer. He's staff writer at The Atlantic. Hello, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, great to have you with us.
Hello, Jane, Adam, and Kim.
So let me begin with the memorial service for George Floyd yesterday, a service that mourned a man whose death has inspired a movement. Kimberly, I'll start with you. A powerful moment, that moment of silence we heard from the Reverend Al Sharpton there. Tell us about the memorial.
Yes, and that moment of silence, I know watching and contemplating during that time, it felt like such an eternity. And I feel that for so many reasons, for so many people, that really brought home the idea of how George Floyd died and the level of brutality that was involved with someone who could kneel on another human being for that eternally long period of time. And Reverend Al Sharpton did that, and it was right after he spoke about the proverbial knee on one's neck. Throughout history, that has been a symbol that Black people have used to describe not just violence against them, but an inability to access economic equality, educational equality, criminal justice equality, in so many different ways. And to have that to have been the symbol for this, it brought it home in a poetic way. Mm-hmm. It was really a moment not just to mourn George Floyd. We heard from his family who talked about things growing up with him and what he was like, but a way for a nation to mourn where we are as a country, where things like this, these sort of slayings at the hands of police and at the hands of people who act as police, are still happening. Mm-hmm.
This was the first of several memorials for George Floyd in the coming days across the country. Well, murder charges were filed this week against all four officers in George Floyd's death. An upgraded second-degree murder charge against Derek Chauvin, the former police officer who pinned Floyd to the ground by his neck. And three other officers at the scene are now charged with aiding and abetting the killing. They were in court yesterday. And two of the former police officers turned on Derek Chauvin, the senior officer. So it's very clear that these officers will not be presenting a united front. Kimberly, tell us what happened in their court appearance yesterday.
Well, I think what we're going to see as this moves forward, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. How these officers are tried, who will testify against each other. It seems that it's not going to be one simple trial. But I think what the people in Minneapolis and across the country are going to be watching now is what justice looks like. So frequently in these cases where you have a police officer, an unarmed Black person, who dies at the hands of a police officer, if there is an arrest, there tends not to be a conviction. And that is one reason that we have seen the frustration and anger that has led to these protests. So I think the way this case is handled, the fact that it took so long to charge all four officers alone has been a point of frustration. So I think people are going to be watching very carefully how this trial moves forward, how these proceedings move forward. And that's something that seems like justice come out as a result.
So Derek Chauvin now has a second-degree murder charge, as well as the third-degree manslaughter charge. These charges carry decades of prison time. Minnesota's governor announced that the state attorney general would take over this case from the Hennepin County attorney general. And here he is, the Minnesota attorney general, Keith Ellison, holding a press conference on Wednesday to announce these upgraded charges against Derek Chauvin.
George Floyd mattered. He was loved. His family was important. His life had value, and we will seek justice for him and for you, and we will find it. The very fact that we have filed these charges means that we believe in them. But what I do not believe is that one successful prosecution can rectify the hurt and loss that so many people feel.
Ellison seemed to be lowering expectations this week a bit, Jack Beatty. He said himself it's hard to convict the police, and these upgraded charges may be even more difficult for him, Jack.
Yes, I've heard that. And people, you know, as it's come out here, where it's a national learning opportunity, we've found out about the limited immunity to prosecution that policemen have. And it seems all they have to do is in trials to say, I was in fear of my life, and juries say, well, that's enough for me, and vote to acquit. So that's but it's hard to see in that video how that could plausibly in any sane reckoning be a claim that Officer Chauvin could make. You know, I'm so glad that General Ellison is taking this on, because you have to wonder, suppose this had been done at the start, the Hennepin County District Attorney. Suppose they had indicted these people right out of the bat, would that have tamped down some of this response? One doesn't know. But it was telling that a week ago, when that district attorney spoke, he said that perhaps even the charges against Chauvin would have to be, that there was some mitigating evidence in there, words to that effect. Just the wrong note entirely. And I think the governor acting rightly, perhaps has acted lately, in putting General Ellison in charge.
CBS News reported last night that Derek Chauvin worked as a security guard at the same nightclub as George Floyd, and that possibly he may have known him, and that this may have been personal in some way. Kimberly Atkins, George Floyd's brother, believes this was a premeditated act. That's what he said. And the family is pushing for a first-degree murder charge. You're an attorney. What about these charges, these upgraded charges?
Yeah, I mean, as for the charges themselves, the one problem with the initial third-degree murder charge was that the elements of it, the technical elements of the crime, did not really fit the facts of the case. And when you have a situation like that, it is very easy for those charges to be dropped on a technical matter. Generally speaking, when someone is charged, they're charged with the highest crime, and then it's a matter of either giving a jury the option to convict of that, or of a lesser included charge, or of the defendant and the prosecutor agreeing to some sort of plea deal to a lesser charge. It doesn't tend not to go the other way around. You don't get charged up unless there's a change in facts. So that's an important symbol there. Look, I don't know whether they knew each other. There was the reporting that they did both work as security in the same place. I know from my experience, there are times that I see people at work or I know them, and in a different setting when they see me, particularly when it's not another person of color, they don't always recognize me. So I don't know in that moment whether Officer Chauvin recognized him or not. But either way, I mean, it seems very difficult it may make it worse, but I don't think it makes it any better.
Two different autopsy reports this week on George Floyd. Both conclude the death was a homicide, but they differ on what caused it. The medical examiner said it was cardiopulmonary arrest. The Floyd family's independent autopsy said it was asphyxiation from sustained pressure. Adam, did you cover this? Are there discrepancies in this report?
Well, obviously, there's a discrepancy between what the medical examiner said and what the private the independent medical examiner said, but I mean, I think it's going to be very hard for the defense, for defense attorneys to argue that Chauvin wasn't responsible for Floyd's death under these circumstances, given the video, given what we saw, given the nature of the restraint and the fact that it's dangerous. I think that the real issue with all of these kinds of prosecutions is that juries really tend to give cops the benefit of the doubt, and they really give them the benefit of the doubt when the person, when the victim is a black man. So I think, you know, it's really hard to tell, you know, whether it's going to make a difference in terms of what the verdict ultimately is.
Kimberly Atkins, what struck you about the protests? 10 days straight, 10 days of protests this week in this country. Many of them, riotous, some of them more peaceful. Have you noticed tensions easing? What are you noticing? What are you seeing now out there as you look at these protests?
Well, it seems as each day goes by, that the protests have gotten more peaceful. I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think it's one, the organizers and participants in the protesters have been doing their part to try to put down the instances of outside agitators coming in and seeing, trying to escalate the situation, saying, no, we're not here to break windows and set things on fire. We're here to demand justice. And I think we've seen some of that. I think we've seen some cities react to what is happening on the ground. We saw lots of curfews going into place, for example, and it seemed night after night, once the curfew fell, it gave police an opportunity to try to enforce the curfew. And in the course of that, there was a conflict where we saw many videos of police officers using excessive force against the protesters. And then mayors began lifting or delaying those curfews, and we saw fewer instances of that. But and also we saw a very diverse crowd of people.
Broad protests
happening all over the world. So I think all of those are remarkable.
It is the week in the news. When we come back after the break, we'll talk about President Trump's walk to St. John's Church this week and military leaders breaking with the president. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. More to come. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing the week in the news this hour, and we have a great panel to guide us through the week. WBUR's Kimberly Atkins, Adam Serwer from The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Several incidents this week worth noting related to the protests around the country. In Louisville, the police chief was fired when two officers involved in the fatal shooting of a black business owner did not activate their body cams. In Atlanta, six officers charged after pulling two young people from their cars and shooting them with stun guns while they were stuck in traffic caused by the protest. Another video that was hard to watch. The couple appeared on CNN on Wednesday to talk about both the physical and the mental toll of the encounter. Here's one of the victims, Tanya Pilgrim.
When something so devastating happens, when there's no preparation, there's, you know, no explanation, there's almost no way to get over it. All I can hope for is, like I said, is for people to be held accountable. Like, because I don't want this to continue to happen and have more victims like us who are traumatized, who can't sleep, can't eat. I don't want that for anyone else.
Back in Washington, security personnel, including members of the National Guard, used tear gas and rubber bullets on peaceful protesters to forcibly and violently clear a path for President Trump to walk across the street to St. John's Church, where the president then held up a Bible. Adam Serwer, can you speak to this? Describe the scene for us.
Well, there was an initial attempt to say that the protesters hadn't been cleared for that reason or that tear gas hadn't been used. And obviously, we now know that's not the case. But look, it's really ridiculous. I mean, the government violently clearing peaceful protesters for the purpose of granting the president a photo op is just an obvious and blatant suppression of free speech. And it just shouldn't have happened. And the fact that the fact that the president and attorney general even felt comfortable doing that the way that they did it is just really outrageous.
So earlier in the day, the president had briefly retreated to a bunker beneath the White House, and several reports indicated that Mr. Trump did not want to appear that he was in hiding. So he went out, gave a speech in the Rose Garden. Here's a bit of that speech on Monday from the White House Rose Garden.
As we speak, I am dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, and law enforcement officers to stop the rioting, looting, vandalism, assaults, and the wanton destruction of property.
And so in that moment, Kimberly Atkins, tear gas, rubber bullets being fired on these peaceful protesters. What did you see in this spectacle?
Yeah, it served as an inflection point in a lot of ways. Yes, the reporting is that this happened in part because the president was frankly embarrassed by reports that he had been rushed into a bunker. He had tweeted before that he felt safe, and this was some sort of show that the president can walk out of the front of the White House and walk out, and he was not afraid. And it took the clearing of Lafayette Park of peaceful protesters in order to effectuate that. That was reportedly the decision made by Attorney General Barr. And to boot, there was a nice slick White House video that was put out a little while later. Of the president doing this. So clearly this was meant to be, it was referred to as a photo op, and it appeared very much that that is what it was. But it was accompanied by this call for the militarized response of local police against protesters. And that was a main part of the point. The president not only held up this Bible in a way that seemed a signal to his white evangelical supporters, but also promoting this law and order approach that he thought was necessary. He had excoriated governors in a phone call hours earlier, saying that they looked weak because they weren't putting down these protests with more force. So it was a clear line that the president was drawing in how he thought that these protests should be addressed.
Jack Beatty, as Kimberly said, it's been reported that AG Barr, Bill Barr, ordered this use of force, this tactical intervention to clear this path for the president. Barr called the protesters a witch's brew of extremist agitators. Tell me what you saw this week.
Well, I didn't see that in that group. I watched a good deal of the period before that on CNN, and as the commentators, as the reporters asserted, it was a peaceful assemblage, people exercising their right of free speech to petition the government for redress of, in this case, a horrible grievance. And the Attorney General's almost willful, it strikes me, misreading, which doesn't seem to, and earlier he'd come out with rhetoric about Antifa, which is a kind of conspiracy, I guess. People say it almost doesn't exist. It's such a loose assemblage of personages. But the point is, in the arrests, you don't see that. The arrests around the country are almost, not all of them, but the large percentage, local people. And yes, I have no doubt there have been some agitators. But this is, on the part of the Attorney General, I think this is just a kind of shameful moment. It shouldn't escape our notice, Jane, that before the president made his speech about, you know, law and order, he spoke on the phone with Vladimir Putin. And when he told the governors that the whole world is laughing at you, you're a laughing stock in the world, I wonder if he wasn't just reflecting what Mr. Putin had told him. And I don't think that'll escape the notice of historians.
Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy leads the Episcopal Diocese in Washington. She told CNN that clergy were not alerted ahead of time about the president's plans to come and visit St. John's on Monday after it had been vandalized in protests.
Let me be clear about it. He did not come to pray. He did not come to express remorse or consolation. He did not come to share the grief or to provide hope to the thousands of young people who were gathered in the park that day. He did nothing to say to them that your future is before you and I will protect you and do all that we can to make this country worthy of you, all the things that we need and deserve from anyone who is in leadership, spiritual or political, at this time.
Actually, a chorus of religious leaders have expressed dismay at what happened at St. John's, Adam Serwer.
Well, that's not surprising. I think in the same way that you saw a lot of military leaders speaking out because they don't want the military to be politicized, I think people clergy do not like the idea of churches and other houses of worship being used in such a cynical political manner. And I think that in this case, it was so obviously cynical, so obviously an attempt by the president to, show everybody that he's actually a big, strong man and he wasn't hiding in a bunker somewhere, that it's not surprising that there are so many people who responded negatively to it.
So speaking of the military being politicized, the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were apparently paraded into this photo op in front of the church, though they said they did not know in advance about the crowd being dispersed. They didn't know sort of exactly what was happening. They thought they were going to review the troops, which makes this even more bizarre, Kimberly.
It does. I mean, it was what a remarkable moment. It speaks not only to the complete lack of coordination and communication from within this administration, but it just shows how the political maneuvering by the president can catch up everyone, including the national, including the Secretary of Defense. And this became another inflection moment for the military, which caused General Esper to later say that Secretary Esper to say that he did not agree with using military force against American citizens, a sentiment that was then echoed by Mike Mullen, the former chair of the Chiefs of Staff, and former Defense Secretary James Mattis, who put out a statement saying that the president is keen on fomenting division and not bringing the country together, and that he was the first president that he has seen to act in that way. So, look, it's not the first time we've seen the president politicize the military. Recall that he barred transgender troops by a tweet, and that the White House wanted the SS John McCain removed from his sight during his visit to Japan. But in this case, this order to have the military go into cities and states was a bridge too far for many of the military's top brass.
Here's the clip to which you refer, Kimberly. Here's Secretary of Defense Esper breaking with President Trump on Wednesday when he said he does not support using military force against protesters. He invoked not only his role as the Department of Defense Secretary, but his career as a soldier and a former member of the National Guard.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now. I do not support invoking the Insurrection Act.
Jack Beatty, there were real questions, actually, about whether the Secretary of Defense was going to hold his job after contradicting the president on this. And, you know, one of several military leaders who did, Jack.
Yes. And to call it tepid, the White House endorsement, I think the press secretary said, well, he still has his job or something like that. If the president didn't like him, he wouldn't be in the job. You know, on this program, commentators regularly and rightly criticize the acquiescence of Republican senators and congressmen in the president's worst moments. Not so this week. I think we need to say that Senators Sass, Murkowski, Collins, Scott, Graham, Congressman Hurd, and others have spoken out against this. And I think that's worthy of remark because it's hard to do for them, especially those of them that are on the ballot. And that may go to Kimberly's point that this was quote, inflection point. Something might have changed with this opera buffet display, this authoritarian assertion, this override of constitutional rights, all for a photo op. maybe something is changing, and I think these GOP senators speak to that.
In fact, Lisa Murkowski, the Alaska senator, said she was struggling with her support of Donald Trump now, whether she can actually vote for him. She said, "We've reached a point where, quote, we can be honest with the concerns we hold internally about the president." That is a shift, Adam Serwer, for Murkowski and for others, it appears.
I mean, it is a shift, but I don't want to overplay it. Look, when the Access Hollywood tape came out with a recording of the president discussing the fact that he engages in sexual assault, a lot of Republicans pulled back and said, "Oh, I don't know if I can support this guy," because they thought he was going to lose. And then when the Comey letter came out, all these Republicans, they fell in line immediately as soon as the president won. So what's happening here is that the president's polling's bad. It looks like he might lose, and so people are feeling a little brave. But if Trump somehow bounces back and pulls through, you're going to see all these same people fall right back in line.
Let me get to Kimberly. You brought up General Mattis. He took issue, and this was an extraordinary rebuke. Extraordinary criticism. General Mattis said that President Trump's threat of military force during the riots, we are witnessing the consequences of 3 years without mature leadership, that the president is trying to divide the country. He's a threat to the Constitution. I mean, just an extraordinary back and forth between these current and former Pentagon officials, Kim.
Yes. And on one hand, it is remarkable. Secretary Mattis said when he left the job that he planned to maintain what he saw as a duty of silence, not speaking out against an administration for which he worked once he left. And now clearly he is making a different calculation, although we did see that very critical resignation letter when he did leave office. He was very critical of the president and his view of the world. But on the other hand, you have to recall that for all of those other instances that the president politicized the military that I named, General Mattis was at the helm then, and he had the opportunity to do things from the inside, to be more effective from within the Pentagon, rather than now speaking now that he has left. So I think there are two ways to look at what General Mattis is doing now.
Let me get to the phone call that President Trump had with governors to talk about how to handle the protests happening across the country. Here's what President Trump said to the governors on Monday.
You have to dominate. If you don't dominate, you're wasting your time. They're going to run over you. You're going to look like a bunch of jerks. You have to dominate. And you have to arrest people, and you have to try people. And they have to go to jail for long periods of time.
If you don't dominate, you're going to look like a bunch of jerks. Adam Serwer, the response to that, specifically from the governors, if you know?
Well, I mean, obviously, you can see that none of the governors requested, requested that the president send out the troops to dominate the protesters, because they recognize that these people are their citizens. The president is only thinking of these protests in terms of the fact that they make him look bad because he ran on law and order, and now everything looks like chaos. But most of the nation's governors do not actually want to unleash brutality on their own citizens, and the president's appetite for that is actually quite disturbing.
Jack, what did you hear in that call?
Oh, I entirely agree with Adam. I mean, what could be more disturbing than to hear a president talk like that and almost seem to relish, not only to polarize, but to relish violence? Earlier in a tweet, he spoke of, trespassers in the White House grounds will be met with vicious dogs, titillating himself with these images of violence. There's a streak in this man that is profoundly disturbing on just the moral and psychological level, I think.
I can't let this segment go without speaking about Ahmaud Arbery, because this week we learned more about the final moments of his life, the young African-American man who was shot and killed while jogging in Georgia. At a court hearing for the three men charged with murdering Arbery, prosecutors stunned the courtroom with the information that one of the suspects called Arbery a racial epithet after allegedly shooting him. Kim Atkins, the Department of Justice, now looking at federal hate crimes in this case, charges in this case. Just a terrible addition to this already awful story.
It really is. And look, federal hate crime charges are among the hardest to bring and make stick. But I can't imagine a case that seems to warrant it more than this one. I think the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, the images of that is a big part of why the protests we are seeing and the wake of George Floyd's killing has been so big. It was really a 1-2 punch for Black Americans to see those slayings take place on the streets of America, and the Justice Department, I hope, will take a very close look at that.
More of our weekly news roundtable after the break. We'll talk about the pandemic. New numbers show that 16 states have increased COVID cases. We'll speak about that and more. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. On Monday, we'll hear from a panel of organizers who are protesting racism and police brutality in cities across this country. Have you taken part in demonstrations in your community? What have you witnessed? What are you asking for? We'd love to hear your perspective. Tell us your story. 1-617-353-0683. Give us a call. Today, our weekly roundtable continues, and our panel this hour is Adam Serwer of The Atlantic, Kimberly Atkins with WBUR, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Well, the Labor Department reported that 1.9 million Americans filed new unemployment claims last week. There were also 623,000 new claims for federal aid and self-employed Americans who are not normally eligible for state jobless claims. President Trump just held a press conference where he talked about the economy. He said, quote, "This is a great moment for equality. Just prior to the China plague, we had the best numbers for African Americans, for Hispanic Americans, for everybody. We had the greatest economy in the history of the world, and that strength has helped get us through." Speak to this moment, Adam Serwer, those numbers. I mean, the economy is rebounding more quickly than many expected.
Well, I think that there's, well, it's certainly the case that people did not expect the numbers to be this good as a matter of fact. People were predicting that the unemployment numbers were going to go up. I think that however, there were some people who suggested that we might have a temporary rebound like this. But the question is whether or not we can actually sustain this given, given that the Congress is not inclined to make sure that the businesses and people who are currently laid off, businesses that are shuttered and people who are currently laid off, get the money they need to keep buying things, keep consuming, keep the economy going. So I think obviously the White House wants to take a victory lap here, but we're still very far from out of the woods, and we don't know necessarily that we're on the right path.
Jack Beatty, what did you see in the economy this week?
Well, the president has a talking point, and the stock market rallied strongly this morning.
Yes. But
I was struck with something in the data. Something like 700,000 jobs in government were lost. That's a portent. Unless Congress passes aid to the states, I think over $500 billion is what the Democrats in the House wanted, we're going to see a state
employee, that 700,000 number is going to grow and grow and grow. We're going to have mass layoffs in all the states because they have to balance their budgets. And that, of course, as economists warn, is a route to sort of keeping a recession going. Essentially, you're funding, you're assuring the recession will have some legs because you're laying off so many public employees. And this moment may actually give the Republicans an excuse. Well, we don't need to do anymore. The economy is going to recover on its own. And that would be, for them, a political mistake because, of course, the more money out there, the better the economy is going to do, the better the president will look. And it would be a terrible mistake for the millions of Americans who could continue to struggle to find work.
Well, news regarding the pandemic this week, there was some concern from health experts who say that the protests over the last 10 days in this country will certainly set off new chains of coronavirus infection. There are also new numbers out that show 16 states have increased COVID cases linked to Mother's Day and Memorial Day gatherings. Kimberly Atkins, we've got more than 100,000 new cases worldwide being reported each day. Give us an update on the pandemic in this country.
Yes. I mean, before these numbers came out, there was a worry about two things. One would be a new spike in this current wave of coronavirus caused by warmer weather, people going out, gathering, as you said, Mother's Day and other events, as well as a resurgence in the fall of a new wave. And certainly with these protests, we have seen a lot of people. Many wear masks, but many are very close together. They are not social distancing. We're seeing the law enforcement not social distancing in their response. But I really do have to say that far away from the protests, as the weather has gotten warm, I have seen a lot of people really give up on social distancing. Perhaps it's not seeing Dr. Fauci on our TV screens every day reminding us has really made a lot of people, I think, back off of that. And as good as these job numbers are, as good as these indicators that the economic hit really bottomed out somehow in May, unless you can sustain the numbers of keep the new infection rates low, you're not going to be able to sustain those economic numbers. So it'll take weeks to see what happens out of these protests and out of folks, you know, sitting close together, eating outside at restaurants that I've seen. But the potential could be really devastating, not just for health, but also the economy. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the protests for a moment, because this week former U.S. presidents spoke out about the death of George Floyd. Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama all spoke up this week. It was George W. Bush's statement that was poignant. He said he was anguished by the video of Floyd's death, talked about ending systemic racism in this country. Adam Serwer, what did you hear from the former presidents this week?
Well, I think in some ways you hear what a rhetorical break from previous presidents, regardless of party, Trump is. But also, I think it's important to remember that part of how Trump won was that he rode a backlash from law enforcement unions against Obama, because his civil rights division had actually been very aggressive in engaging in oversight over local law enforcement institutions. And the largest police union in the country endorsed Trump, and Trump, of course, for a very long time, has been sort of rhetorically committed to police doing whatever they want to suspects from the time that he took out an ad suggesting that the now exonerated Central Park Five should be given the death penalty, to his president when he told an audience of police that they could mistreat suspects. But as a matter of policy, he has also pulled back entirely from the kind of oversight that the Obama administration did of local police departments. So in some ways, when we're looking at these protests and why they are so widespread, we actually don't have as much of a good idea as we should about what the practices of these local police departments are, and why people might be reacting to them in the way that they are.
Back to the presidents speaking up this week. Former President Barack Obama gave a video address about George Floyd's killing from his home on Wednesday. He called the events of this past week as profound as anything he has witnessed in his lifetime, and said that protests and politics can work in tandem to effect real change. Here he is.
This is not a either or. This is a both and. To bring about real change, We both have to highlight a problem and make people in power uncomfortable, but we also have to translate that into practical solutions and laws that can be implemented and we can monitor and make sure we're following up on.
President Obama urging Americans to make real change over and over. He said that about, you know, what's happening right now. Jack Beatty, what did you hear there?
Well, importantly there, he said, look at local elections. And he pointed to Ferguson, Missouri, which just elected Ella Jones, a black woman mayor. That's Ferguson, Missouri. And he said that you got to vote on the local issues. And one of those issues is got to be now police reform. This week, Vox published some data about what could be a voting issue for citizens. And it was a sort of score averaging of police training. And across the nation, something like 60%, 60 hours of training for firearms and something like 4 hours of training for community relations. This is police. This is the average, apparently, in the country, something like that. And, you know, what should people vote on in their local elections? To change that, those trainings for policemen. Let's have less firearms and more community relations. But that's a concrete demand that protesters and voters can make on local officials.
Well, in response to what has been happening over the last 10 days, Joe Biden gave his first major speech in public since the coronavirus hit, but directed his comments in Philadelphia to President Trump, saying he was fanning the flames of hate, that he'd turn this country into a battlefield. Here he is on Tuesday in Philadelphia talking about racial tensions in this country and what he says is at stake in the upcoming election.
The moment has come for our nation to deal with systemic racism, to deal with the growing economic inequity that exists in our nation, to deal with the denial of the promise of this nation, made to so many.
Kim Atkins, did Joe Biden meet the moment here? What did you hear?
Well, clearly, Joe Biden is showing one of the most clear distinctions that he has between the president in both style and substance when it comes to responding to this protest and the outrage over the killing of unarmed black people. You have the president pushing for the military to go in and basically put down this protest. And you have former Vice President Biden speaking to the pain and the hurt and the outrage at the president's response to this. And so at a time when the coronavirus has taken the presidential election off the air and essentially still given the president a vehicle to speak every day, and Joe Biden hasn't been able to have that, this was a moment that he got it. The speech was carried by networks, which I think speaks to another issue. If you remember this time 4 years ago, Donald Trump couldn't sneeze without getting wall-to-wall cable news coverage.
That's right.
And Joe Biden has not been given that same amount of coverage. So I think it's a push also to the media about how this election is being covered at this critical time. Mm.
On Tuesday, voters in seven states and the District of Columbia navigated curfews and health concerns and went to the polls, sometimes waiting in line for hours. Adam Serr, with wins in seven states, Joe Biden is quickly closing in on this nomination, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there's any question but that Biden's going to end up being the nominee. His main rival has dropped out. I think, you know, the challenge for him as a nominee, I think, at this moment is that while he's polling really well, there appears to be some weakness with younger voters and with Hispanic voters. And that's something that his campaign is going to really have to deal with if they want to make sure they win in November.
Speaking of November, President Trump this week said that he's pulling the Republican National Convention from North Carolina because the governor there, Roy Cooper, who is a Democrat, has refused to guarantee that coronavirus restrictions would not impact the convention. Kimberly Atkins, what did you hear this week in President Trump making this quite dramatic move?
Yes, I mean, it is a dramatic move, but it's right in line with President Trump's insistence that the country open up. And he has this image of an RNC convention that looked like the one 4 years ago, where there are lots of people in a packed stadium, and the governor is saying, look, there's no way that this can happen. And so it's just yet another example of this divide, the way the president wants to see things go back to normal and really put the coronavirus aside. But you have governors who, by the way, are implementing the Trump administration's own guidelines from the CDC about gatherings and how you carry things forward, trying to enforce them, and the president pulling it rather than trying to find some sort of middle ground. So right now the convention doesn't have a home. We'll see if another city gives them one.
And do we know where it might be, where that city might be?
As of the last time I checked, I don't. But yeah, it's going to be very difficult to see how the president can pull off the type of convention he's envisioning.
Well, let's circle back as we end here to where we began with protests across this country. I wanted to play this clip. A Maryland singer named Kenny Sway led protesters in a sing-along of Bill Withers' hit Lean On Me this week. And I wanted to take a listen to these protesters singing together outside the White House. This was on Wednesday. Just an extraordinary moment, one of many over these last 10 days. Let me turn to the panel for your thoughts as we close this week of protests and difficulty. Adam Serwer, I start with you.
Well, I think, you know, we've seen something pretty extraordinary, which is, I think, the proliferation of cell phone cameras and the ability to record and provide a window for the rest of the country into what are all too common experiences for Black people with law enforcement, I think has really changed the political understanding of the extent of racism and discrimination in this country and how widespread it is and how much it really shapes people's lives. And I think that's something that's actually quite extraordinary, and I'm not sure that we've ever seen it before to this level.
Kimberly Atkins, thoughts on these protests as we close out here?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that is not always in the conversation about why people are so angry, particularly people of color, is the trauma from seeing these images. It's impossible for Black people to see the video of men being killed in the street without thinking of themselves or their brothers or sisters or mothers or fathers or children in the place of that. So I think that's one thing when folks are just seeing this as characterizing this as an excuse to make trouble or to damage property, what is really at the heart for so many of these protesters. And I think that's an important part of this conversation.
It sure is. Jack Beatty, I'll give you the last word. We have about a minute here.
Well, I give it to a woman named Margaret Kawanka of Dorchester, Mass., quoted in the Boston Globe, an African-American woman. She said she was a protester. She said, "We came out because it's finally clear that all people care, like white people care." And she's drawing attention there to the biracial, multiracial character of this protest. And in this terrible moment for African-Americans, that solidarity that young white and other Americans feel with them, I hope that gives them a measure of assurance that this is going to change.
A week, a period in history never to be forgotten. Many thanks to our panel today. Kimberly Atkins, senior news correspondent for WBUR. Kimberly, thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
Adam Serwer, staff writer for The Atlantic. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Great as always, Jack, to have you. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.